This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, more on the domestic and international fallout from the surprise election of Republican Donald J. Trump. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. Mr. Trump is no ordinary president-elect. Though nominally a Republican, he campaigned on a platform that fused traditional Republican promises of less regulation and lower taxes with a populist attack on globalism in all its forms, free trade, immigration, and international finance. On this edition of the program, we will delve a bit more into what factors propelled him to his electoral victory and discuss how the Republican Party, which now controls both chambers of Congress and the White House, might reconcile its internal differences. Is the Republican Party Trump's party now, more populist and less establishment? Is there room for mainstream conservatives who have traditionally championed smaller government, free trade, and a strong U.S. role in the world? How can Mr. Trump bring back jobs in the steel and coal industries without causing other adverse disruptions in the national economy? We will also discuss the fate of the Democratic Party. How will it regroup in the face of its losses? Will Democrats embrace the more populist so-called Bernie Sanders wing, or will they forge a new compact that addresses concerns of the white working and rural classes in America who helped propel Republican Donald Trump to victory? With us to discuss the domestic and international ramifications of the election results are Alan Lichtman. He's Distinguished Professor of History at American University, author and leading expert on presidential and congressional campaigns. He's the author of many books, including White Protestant Nation, and is the co-creator of a historically based model that has correctly predicted the winner of the popular vote in the last 8 presidential contests. And Molly Hemingway. She's senior editor of the conservative online magazine The Federalist. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Well, Alan Lichtman, let me begin with you. You were among the few, if not the only, analysts that thought Trump had the advantage and would likely win. Talk about why.
I was able to predict correctly a Trump victory, and I even doubled down on it in 2 interviews with the Washington Post, because I don't look at polls, I don't listen to the pundits, and I don't follow the day-to-day events of the campaign. Rather, my predictions are based on an historically established system. I developed it in 1981 in collaboration with the world-renowned mathematician Volodya Kylas-Borok. We looked at every American presidential election from 1860 to 1980, guided by the thesis that presidential elections are primarily judgments on the strength and performance of the party holding the White House. And we derived 13 key factors, the 13 keys to the White House, which gauge the prospects for the party holding the White House. And if 6 or more of those keys go against the White House party, they're predicted losers. And I was able to discern from this system the many vulnerabilities that the incumbent Democrats had. They took a big pasting in the midterm elections of 2014. They did not have their sitting president running. Open seats are tough. There was a third party bedeviling them through most of the campaign. They had a contentious nomination struggle because Republicans decided they would obstruct everything Barack Obama tried to do. In the second term, there was no major domestic policy accomplishment, and they didn't have a big foreign policy accomplishment. And Hillary Clinton was certainly a perfectly good candidate. This election loss cannot be pinned on her. She beat Donald Trump handily in all 3 debates, but she wasn't the once-in-a-generation inspirational candidate.
We do note that reports indicate that Democrat Hillary Clinton surpassed Donald Trump in the popular vote by more than 1 million votes. How do we reconcile the Electoral College with this outcome?
Great question. You know, when I first developed the keys in 1981, the popular vote drove the Electoral College vote. You had to go back all the way to 1888 to find a divergence. Since then, though, there has been an enormous sea change in our politics, and that is the popular vote is now dissevered from the Electoral College vote in any close election, which is why I did not, as I have in the past, you know, just talk about the popular vote. I talked about who would win. Here's what's happened. You have New York and California, 2 huge states that are non-competitive and pile up millions of extra votes for any Democrat. Those millions of extra votes pad the popular vote, but have no impact whatsoever on the Electoral College. There is no comparable set of states for Republicans that are non-competitive and pile up as many votes. There's only Texas. So this would suggest there is a fundamental disconnect in our politics now, something new, and it needs to be addressed. I think we need to get rid of the Electoral College, but I'm a dreamer. That's not going to happen.
Well, there's a petition going around the country to do just that, but we don't know where that's going to go. Let me turn now to Molly Hemingway. Molly Hemingway, Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives Paul Ryan, asserted that due to his Electoral College victory, Mr. Trump has a mandate. Does he have a mandate? Is this Trump's Republican Party now? We know there are many fissures between his more populist brand of the GOP and the mainstream conservatives as the Tea Party. How do you see this playing out?
I'm not the biggest fan of the term mandate. I think you either hold power or you don't, and you choose what to do with it. It's true that Donald Trump won a very tough race. He clearly has a bully pulpit, and he will use it. Republicans also did well. They controlled the Senate and the House. They control most of the governor's offices throughout the land. They controlled the vast majority of state legislatures. So there is some sort of emerging consensus in favor of general conservative policies. What's interesting is the, as you note, the fissure between Donald Trump's populism and the conservative principles that people also support. I don't think we know how that's going to bear out. At the same time, there's not an inherent disconnect between populism and conservatism. Most notably, this is a country that values self-government, and I think what we saw was a big cry towards self-government against elite control of many institutions of power. And you see this on both left and right, that there is a concern about who is making decisions and who those decisions benefit. And so it'll be interesting to see if there is some sort of realignment underneath a Donald Trump presidency against those concerns.
Turning back to you, Alan Lichtman, notwithstanding some of the points of convergence that Molly Hemingway noted between mainstream conservatives and the populist Republicans that Mr. Trump represents, there are some disturbing developments that many analysts, both on the right and the left, have noted. Now, we see that in some of his White House appointments so far. His association with the so-called alt-right movement, that's a movement that has ties with white supremacists. This alt-right movement promotes a very nationalist narrative bordering on intolerance and even hate of the other. Are you, for example, concerned about the appointment of Steve Bannon, his former campaign manager, to the position of White House counselor and strategist? He is affiliated with this movement, and some are concerned that this appointment sends a message of normalizing these types of views, which were heretofore seen as on the fringe.
The appointment of Steve Bannon shakes me to the core of my being, and I'll explain that in a moment. But first, I want to challenge the common premise that somehow Trump is an anti-establishment, people's-type candidate. Trump is the poster child of the establishment. Everyone thinks the establishment is just the politicians in Washington. That's half the establishment. The other half of the establishment are the wealthy special interests who manipulate the politicians in their own interest. And nobody but nobody has done that better throughout his career than Donald Trump. He has made his riches on special tax breaks and other concessions that he's gotten from political influence. So Trump is the establishment. He's no populist. He's no anti-establishment. Moreover, look at his policies. Boy, I'm going to stick it to you wealthy elites by giving you big tax cuts and deregulating so you can do anything you want. How is that populist? How is that taking it to the special interests? It's just catering to the special interests. Steve Bannon. I don't know Steve Bannon. I would not call him a racist because I don't know. However, through Breitbart News, he has channeled and legitimized what I consider some of the worst elements of our society, the white supremacists, the anti-Semites, the misogynists. And this term alt-right is completely misleading. It means nothing, alt-right. What does that say? We're talking about the radical right. In my book, White Protestant Nation, in terms of the modern right, I trace it back to the beginning of the 20th century. In the 1920s, the Ku Klux Klan had 5 million members. That would translate to 25 million members today. We had Jim Crow. We had segregation of schools. We had restrictive covenants. We had an immigration law that discriminated against Jews and Catholic. So these elements have always been there, but someone like Steve Bannon in the modern era has given them legitimacy, has inflamed them. And I am truly frightened that someone who has been a channel for the most reprehensible elements in our society is sitting at the seat of power in the White House.
Molly Hemingway, are you also troubled, concerned about the appointment of Steve Bannon, who, as Alan Lichtman says, in a sense legitimizes some of these worst instincts that do exist here in society, whether it's anti-Semitism, xenophobia, anti-immigrant, anti-minority? How concerned are you that, for example, a group like the Ku Klux Klan actually endorsed President-elect Trump, and now he has put his former campaign manager, Steve Bannon, in a sense, almost normalizing some of these very undesirable tendencies?
I think nothing normalizes these fringe groups so much as a lot of media obsession on them. They're actually very fringe in American culture. There are very bad people on all political issues, and America has a legacy of including some pretty horrific racism. At the same time, when you look at their actual size in the population, it is extremely small. The Ku Klux Klan barely exists anymore. There have probably been more stories written about the Ku Klux Klan than actual Ku Klux Klan members. It's not to say that this shouldn't be watched or monitored or people should be concerned about it. At the same time, the nonstop focus that you're seeing on some news programs of these fringe elements does far more to normalize and give credibility to these groups than their minor existence itself. It will be important for the media to have a voice of credibility during this presidency. And the more that there are these freakouts over fringe elements, and the more that they characterize all Trump voters as bigots, as racist. This was an underlying current throughout the media coverage of the campaign, was that you couldn't support Donald Trump unless you were a racist and a bigot. There has been a lot of crying wolf about how if you have a different idea about immigration policy, you're a bigot. If you have a different idea about anything, you know, you get called a bigot or a racist. And these terms thereby lose their meaning and their significance. And it can cause real damage when you actually do want to fight bigotry and racism if you are not taken seriously. So I would encourage people in the media who have these voices to think very carefully and make sure they prove their case rather than just making a claim that someone is a racist or a bigot. Those terms have lost their value and their meaning, and you have to actually make the case.
First of all, certainly I did not, in my commentary, talk about Trump voters in general, smear Trump voters in general. I talked specifically about Steve Bannon and Breitbart News. Secondly, while the Ku Klux Klan and organizations like that might be small, this is how it starts. This is how these ideas get normalized and get propagated, particularly when you've got someone who's a channel for these ideas sitting in the seat of power in the White House. And these ideas, while organizationally may be small, historically have been a major component, unfortunately, of American life, and they can't be dismissed so easily.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Alan Lichtman, Distinguished Professor of History at American University, and leading expert on presidential elections, and Molly Hemingway. She's senior editor of the conservative online magazine, The Federalist. And we're discussing more about the domestic and international fallout from the election of Donald J. Trump. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castillo VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Delson Jonah. He's a loyal fan from Plateau State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Alan Lichtman, to discuss what's going to become of the Democrats now. How do you think they're going to be regrouping? Are they going to go more toward the Bernie Sanders wing? What are the various tugs of war that you see inside the party?
One thing the party must not do if it wants to survive and even thrive in the future is blame this defeat on Hillary Clinton. As I explained before, this defeat was due to forces above and beyond anything Hillary Clinton could control. And blaming it on Hillary Clinton would divert from the real work the party has to do. Right now, the Democrats are a shadow party. They don't hold power virtually anywhere in America. So what do they need to do? First of all, they do need to regroup programmatically. They need to develop a clear message and a clear set of policies that do speak broadly to working class and middle class Americans. I do believe that the Sanders message is one that could resonate broadly across America, with one exception. And I think Sanders has done the Democratic Party a great service, but a great disservice in steering the Democratic Party towards protectionism and somehow remaking protectionism, which has always been historically a reactionary, conservative, pro-business policy. Look at the Smoot-Hawley tariff passed through Congress by two very conservative Republicans that plunged us into a ever deeper depression. Protectionism is not progressive. Protectionism does not help the working class and middle class. Those coal jobs, those steel jobs are not coming back. All you're going to do with protectionism is raise prices substantially and stick it to the working class. So the Bernie Sanders message without protectionism. Second thing Democrats need to do is rebuild their grassroots organization. Democratic grassroots used to be based in the labor movement. And at one time, the labor movement encompassed about a third of the workforce. Today, it's down to 8%. You've got to rebuild new grassroots organizations. Clinton had the supposed vaunted turnout machine. It didn't work because it was top-down rather than bottom-up. Now you've got all this energy out there, all these demonstrations, all these protests. Well, unless that is converted to real organization, to enlisting people to work for the Democratic Party, it's going to be like smoke through the chimney, simply go off in the ether.
Molly Hemingway, a similar question to you, but on the Republican side. Now, Alan Lichtman spoke of protectionism with respect to Bernie Sanders, but protectionism seems to be one of the hallmarks of Donald Trump's policies going forward, which does break with the GOP orthodoxy, because the Republican Party has evolved since the days of
Smoot and Hawley.
Exactly. And now you have more mainstream Republicans, you know, in favor of international trade. So the question to you is, which wing of the Republican Party will prevail?
There's a saying in politics that you can learn more from a defeat than a victory. And I think this is going to be true. We're going to see a lot of lessons learned by Democrats, and we're not going to see a lot of lessons being learned by Republicans. You know, speaking personally as someone who is a huge fan of free trade, I think that it would be foolish to deny that animus toward free trade did motivate quite a few Donald Trump voters. And I do not think that people in positions of Republican power outside of the Donald Trump White House have come to terms with that. And so it could be navigated simply by the fact that a lot of our free trade agreements do need revisiting and do need renegotiating. And there are opportunities, particularly with Great Britain, to form some new trade alliances that could mask sort of the disagreements on these various sides. At the same time, I think it's incumbent upon the Republican Party to recognize that even if the country is a very center-right country that largely supports free market economics, there is a growing discontent with it.
And as we close, Alan Lichtman, let's look at the impact of Donald Trump's victory abroad as well. Analysts say that his victory tends to embolden thugs and right-wing parties around the world, the likes of which Marie Le Pen in France, who celebrated, Vladimir Putin in Russia, the so-called alt-right party in Germany, and on, and actually makes our traditional allies nervous, NATO allies, EU. Now people are saying that Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany is the nominal leader of the free world because Mr. Trump has said NATO is now potentially obsolete and, as I said, shaking things up. What are your thoughts?
Well, I do think a lot of our allies are very nervous and have every reason to be. And indeed, you correctly indicate that there's kind of a reciprocal relationship between Donald Trump and insular-looking right-wing movements abroad. That is, they both represent a trend that seems to be sweeping the electorate to move in this insular nationalistic direction. And at the same time, Donald Trump's victory in the most important democracy is going to embolden right-wing movements across the world. No question about that. And in terms of Trump's weak support for NATO, maybe he'll back off that. Maybe he won't. We don't really know because he hasn't shown much knowledge of foreign policy. What really worries me, though, is something else. Because he's never released his taxes, breaking with decades of tradition. And It was especially important for him because he's a businessman. He's not someone who came out of the political world. We have no idea what his obligations are to foreign governments or foreign interests, including China and Russia. And now he's turned his businesses over to his children. It's still all in the family. This is not a blind trust. And he's asked for his children to have top security clearances. And his son-in-law may get a high White House position. I see potential for an enormous destructive train wreck between Donald Trump's personal economic interests, which we don't even know exactly what they are, and the national security interests of the United States.
Molly Hemingway, are you equally concerned about a train wreck, a contradiction, or conflict of interest between Donald Trump's personal interests and those of our national security?
I think this is a great example of how people misread this election in many ways. Donald Trump was treated by many people in the media as not having a real message, as being just an insult machine, and he actually had some things that really resonated with Americans. One of those things was of deep frustration with the way that we have been fighting wars and how much we are involved with them. He sort of put forth this idea that we should be more restrained in when we go to war, and then when we go to war, we should actually win those wars. I don't think that people quite understood the frustration Americans have had with how long it's been since we have actually won a war. There is a new seeming sense of global realignment, and I think this also provides a good opportunity to push back a little on something Alan said about how we should not blame Hillary Clinton for her loss. I think that when you lose an election to Donald Trump, there is plenty of blame to go around. And Hillary Clinton is a good source of that blame. She led a life that involved a lot of working with foreign governments, personally profiting from her relationship to the government and her ability to serve as a conduit for money from oligarchies, foreign governments, and various other groups. I think people really
didn't respond to this.
I think people really didn't like that, and they were very frustrated by the corruption and the scandal that seemed to surround the Clintons. And by making it a referendum on Donald Trump, I don't think we did a good job of litigating all that around Hillary Clinton, and it ultimately was a disservice to her because people felt they had no recourse other than to vote against her.
Yeah, I've got to strongly push back against what you just said. Hillary Clinton is the most investigated person in the political history of the United States. For 25 years, she has been investigated time and time and time again. 8 Benghazi investigations. 10 times more Americans serving abroad were killed under the Bush and Reagan administrations than were killed in Benghazi. No investigations, no recriminations. And every one of those investigations have found absolutely no indication of any illegality on the part of Hillary Clinton. Let me finish. In addition, you're suggesting that she personally profited from the Clinton Foundation. Untrue. The Clinton Foundation has done tremendous work all around the world, saving millions of lives. Even Donald Trump praised the Clinton Foundation and made a financial contribution, unusual for him, to the Clinton Foundation. Donald Trump has never served the public in his entire life. In his last 8 years, David Fahrenthold found he's lied about giving to charities. He's given nothing to charities. He has simply personally profited from all his political connections, unlike Hillary Clinton, who has not personally profited from the Clinton Foundation.
So, Molly Hemingway, one more time, you do get the very last word, but what about the Republicans' concern about potential conflicts of interest and how that could adversely impact even their policies or recommended policies? Should Donald Trump release his tax returns? No other candidate who ran for the presidency to date has ever not released his or her tax returns.
He absolutely should return his tax returns, and it's a scandal that he hasn't. And it's also true that there is a lot of concern about other conflicts of interest involving his family members and whatnot. I think what is incumbent upon observers is to wait and see who fills his cabinet. We will learn a lot about how worried we should be by who he chooses, or you know, how optimistic we can be, too, to be fair, by who he chooses and what direction that portends.
On that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Alan Lichtman, he's Distinguished Professor of History at American University, and Molly Hemingway, Senior Editor of the conservative online magazine The Federalist. Thanks to both of you for your terrific insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.